Fixing All the World's Problems in Three Easy Steps. If you like it, you can buy my book afterwards. Before we get controversial, we'll have to go through some shir. It's inevitable, I'm sorry. The Gemara in Krisus tells us that the concept of geirus, conversion, actually goes back to the original conversion. The original conversion was...
What do you mean?
At Har Sinai. Prior to going to Har Sinai, nobody was Jewish. We read about them in the Torah. Adam HaRishon clearly was not Jewish. Noach was not Jewish. Hence his sons, the B'nai Noach, are referred to as non-Jewish people. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were questionable whether they were Jewish or not. There's a lot of discussion about it. But in terms of a Jewish nation, that did not begin until after we left Mitzrayim, until after we left Egypt, until we went to Mount Sinai and we got the Torah. Prior to getting the Torah, there was no Jewish nation. Even if you tell me that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were Jewish, they were Jewish individually. Their children were not Jewish. Right? If you believe that Avram was Jewish and Sarah was Jewish, then Yishmael should be just as Jewish as Yitzchak. We know that's not true. To the extent that even Avram Avinu, any of the others were Jewish, they were only Jewish individually. The concept of a Jewish nation does not start until much later on. The Gemara tells us that just like the same way the Jews became Jewish at Har Sinai, so too, if anybody wishes to join the Jewish nation, they too have to undergo the same process that the Jews at Har Sinai underwent. And the Gemara goes on to explain that there are three major steps in the process. Two for women. For men, there is a need for circumcision, mila. Everyone has to be, you have to go to the mikvah, tvila. And three is, you have to bring a korban. There's a sacrifice that has to be brought. Now, one would imagine that the conversion crisis is that we can't bring the sacrifice anymore. Right? Boy, that would throw everyone for a loop, wouldn't it now? So, really, that's not a problem. The Gemara tells us that in discussing conversion, it says, L'doro seichem. We have a tradition that at any point in history, it has to be possible for somebody to convert. Therefore, now we're in the 9 days. We are mourning the fact that there is no Beis HaMikdash. No Beis HaMikdash means no karbanos. We can't bring the sacrifices. So therefore, if it was imperative that a person bring a sacrifice to become Jewish, no one would be able to be Jewish today. No one would be able to become Jewish today. No one would have been able to become Jewish for almost 2,000 years now. So therefore, the Gemara tells us, no, that when it comes to the sacrifices, that's only when there's a Beis HaMikdash. However, anybody who's a convert or is the descendant of converts should realize that soon enough when the Beis HaMikdash is built, you owe something. There's an IOU. In fact, it's interesting, the Gemara tells us when the Second Temple was first destroyed, people who converted would take the money and put it aside. To hold that one, hopefully, if you remember, the first exile was only 70 years. The hope at the beginning was that the second exile would be of similar, maybe 20 years, 30 years. Mm-hmm. No one suspected it to go this long. So therefore, and other people as well, whenever a woman gives birth, she's supposed to bring a sacrifice, so people putting the money aside. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai finally realizes that this isn't going to be any quick galus and says that we stop doing it nowadays. Right, so nowadays we do not even put aside money for it. The korban is no longer done. Hopefully soon enough when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, then once again we will, whoever has to bring korbanos for this and one of many other reasons, it's hard to imagine anyone here not having to bring a korban, doing something accidentally, etc. At that point that will happen again. So practically nowadays the ceremony of geirus only involves basically two steps, and for women only one step. The two steps being the mila, the circumcision for the men, and the tefila, the going to the mikvah. Each of these have their issues from time to time. For example, the order is supposed to be specifically that first the man is circumcised, then he goes to the mikvah, and he completes. A discussion comes up, and it happens to be practical from time to time, what if you can't do it in order, can you do it in the reverse order? So I remember when I was a student in yeshiva, There was a group of people living in Peru in the Amazon jungle who claimed to be one of the lost tribes, and therefore they wanted to go to Israel on the law of return. They contacted the Jewish agency, and the Jewish agency heard their claims and said, "We're not absolutely convinced that you're Jewish. You know, we're going to require a conversion here." They said, "Fine, bring us to Israel, we'll convert." They said, "No, no, first you convert, then we bring you to Israel." A little confusion here. So I remember what happened was they sent down three rabbis to the jungles of the Amazon to convert this tribe. One of the rabbis was a fellow named Josh Hoffman, who is a never-ending student at Yeshiva. He went down. He
had Denver roots.
What?
He had Denver roots.
He had Cleveland roots.
Denver too.
Okay. Doesn't surprise me in the slightest. So I remember he, those of you know who I used, so before the days of cell phones, there was a payphone that was outside of the Beis Medrash on the third floor, and you ever had to contact, you called that Beis Medrash, whoever answered had to run around and find the person. So he called in and he says, "You know, I need to speak to Rabbi Schechter if possible, if not Rabbi Simon maybe." What was his issue? He said, "The issue is as follows." He says, "You know, we have these 90 converts that we need to do, and the mikveh we're using is a local watering hole. And there's a cholera epidemic going on right now. So to have people jump into the water hole with open wounds is probably not a great idea. So we have two options as we see it. One is do it in the opposite order, or do the circumcisions and wait here for 2 weeks until they heal, which is something that we're not necessarily interested in right now." So the question is the order, what we call ma'akev, is it necessary to do this to the point that if you do it out of order, it's no good? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva on it where he thinks that if you're stuck, you can do it. And the reasoning is very interesting. It relates to another conversion issue, and that is the issue of a woman who's pregnant when she converts. So the question is, if a woman wants to convert and she's pregnant, what is the status of the child? So the issue in the Gemara is not whether the child is Jewish or not, because we believe one way or the other the child is Jewish. The question is, why is the child Jewish? Is the child Jewish because the fetus is a limb of the mother? They call uber yerech imo. And just like when a woman jumps into the mikvah to become Jewish, her hands become Jewish, her feet become Jewish, her kidneys become Jewish, right? Her inner organs, even though they never touch the water, become Jewish. So too, this child is an organ, and that child becomes Jewish as well. That's one approach. The second approach is, no, the child is Jewish, but the child is a convert as well. How does that work? So it works like this. So in the event that a woman, let's say, has to go to the mikvah, so we know that there has to be, it can't be a chatzitza, there can't be anything that's separating her from the water. What if a woman has brain surgery, and she needs to have a metal plate in her head? Is that considered a chatzitza? So the answer is no, it's not, because anything that you need in order to survive, becomes part of you. So the metal plate, even though that's not a natural part of the body, in this case becomes part of her, she's allowed to go to the mikvah. So, viewing the fetus, not as a part of the mother, but rather viewing the fetus as its own being, and we're not going to discuss how this relates to abortion, if we would view it that way, then the child went into the mikvah, and yes, the child did not touch the water, but everything that surrounds the child is the life-supporting system that the child has, right? The embryo cannot live without the mother. Therefore, the mother, even though the child never touched the water, the mother is not considered a chatzitza. The mother does not technically block the water, and therefore, just like the mother has undergone a process, the child has undergone a process as well. Now, there are some very important differences as to how we view it. Yes, the child is born one way or the other as Jewish, but let's say, for example, the child is a boy, which is a 50-50 chance, unless your last name is Rapp. So let's say that would happen, hypothetically. I can't imagine how it happens. So what happens at that point is now the child has to undergo a bris, like all other baby boys. But the question is why? Is the boy having a bris because he's a Jewish boy having a bris, or is he a convert? And he's having a bris as a convert. Who cares? Either way, you serve bagels and lox. What's the difference one way or the other? So one difference is, do you do it on the eighth day? If it's a regular Jewish boy, he should have his bris on the eighth day. If he's a convert, he can have on the eighth day, the ninth day, the seventh day, the fifth day, the 14th day. Whenever you want to do it, that's when you can do it. So that's one difference. Another difference is, technically, is the baby related to the mother? If the child is born Jewish, obviously, he's related to the mother. If the child converted like the mother converted, then they are not related. It's very interesting. We will digress a little bit because it's really, really interesting, is this is somewhat related to a very important medical ethics issue. So nowadays, artificial reproductive technologies have become common. And if you'll, let's say, for example, there's two ways this could happen, the reverse. If a woman, for example, has an incompetent uterus, that she has the ability, she has her eggs, are good eggs, she can create a child, but she does not have the ability to carry the child for 9 months. So at that point, medically, an option is to have a surrogate mother. Anyone else say surrogate mother in Hebrew? It's a funny word. Ein pundakit. What's a pundak? It's a motel. Right? Ein pundakit, right? Yeah, right? Basically, it's a place to hang out. They'll leave the lights on for you. Right? That's what it is medically. Right? So if you have a situation like that, you have one woman is the biological mother, and another woman is the gestational mother. Of course, you can have the reverse as well. You can have a woman who has incompetence in her eggs, but a fine uterus. In that case, you'll have an egg donor, right, donate the eggs, have them fertilized, and have the mother carry them. Now, the obvious question is, well, what if one of these two women are Jewish and the other one is not? Do we care about the biological mother, the one who's genetically related? Or do we care about the gestational mother, the woman who actually carried the baby for 9 months? And these can be very, very tricky. I'll just tell you, in the Beis Din, in 1 week we had the following two questions. Came up in the same week, you'll be amazed. The first was a baby born with Turner syndrome. Anyone familiar with Turner syndrome? Turner syndrome, among the issues that come out of Turner syndrome, is that a female child was born with no eggs. And unlike a male who produces sperm throughout his life, a woman is born with all the eggs she's going to have for her whole life. So if a woman is born with zero eggs, she is infertile. It's over. The mother was around 30 years old, and the mother asked the following question. Can I freeze my eggs and save it for my daughter? And one day my daughter will meet her bashert, they'll get married, they will fertilize my eggs and implant them in her, and she will have children that will be genetically similar to her. Question number one. Okay. Question number two. I have a situation of a woman who's had multiple miscarriages, and the doctors recommend surrogacy. Now the problem is, in many states, including in New York, surrogacy is strongly discouraged for legal reasons. Because you have the baby M issue. You'll have a situation where the surrogate mother will decide she wants to keep the baby. It's her baby. So the general rule is that doctors will not do a surrogacy unless there's some very strong, almost guarantee that this isn't going to happen. What case is that? If you have a member of the family be the surrogate. So in this case, the husband's mother offered to carry her daughter-in-law's baby. Does anyone venture a guess?
So the child with own parent would also be its own mother-in-law.
Right.
Difficulty.
It's a scary thought. It's a little bit like Lot. So the problem is, you can't make everybody happy in this case. If you tell me that the biological mother is the mother, well, that's good news for the second case, right? If we care about the biological mother, the fact that the husband's mother is carrying the baby doesn't matter. However, in the first case, there's no way that you're going to allow the husband to inseminate, to fertilize, his mother-in-law's eggs. And vice versa. If you tell me it's gestational that matters, the first case is okay, but the second case isn't. So this issue of biological versus gestational is very relevant. It comes up much more common than people would imagine. And the question is, where do you turn to? Where possibly, in all of the Torah, are you going to find a situation of somebody where there is a biological mother and a gestational mother, right? 50 years ago, and even less, this was science fiction. So it's interesting that there are places to point to, and one of them is right here. If you tell me that Uber, Lav Yerachimo, that here the child is being born to the woman who is converting, is not Jewish because the child is part of the mother, but rather the child is Jewish because the child is a convert, then you have a fascinating case. You have a child that was conceived by a non-Jewish woman, but given birth to by a Jewish woman. And the question is, well, what do I care about? Do I care who conceived it? Or do I hear who gave birth to it? So one could make an argument, as some do, that perhaps this case has to be analyzed, not just for the Geirus issue, but a far broader issue comes up as well. Going back to the reason we raised this case, is we were discussing the issue of, can a person first go to the mikvah and then have the milah, as opposed to the other way. So the Ramban points out that this is the case. If I assume that the child is having a bris afterwards, not because they're born Jewish, but rather because they in fact are completing the conversion process which started in utero, then what happened here? What was the conversion process for this baby? First, the baby went to the mikvah, and then afterwards, the baby had the bris. So, one would assume that you at least have one case out there where this can be done.
If it's a girl.
If it's a girl, there's no need for a bris.
Obviously. Is she considered a convert, or is she considered born Jewish?
So that's a good question. Now, again, you point out that there are men, even if it's a girl, there are a lot of issues. For example, a convert who is a child. Okay? So, part of the conversion process is a person has to willingly understand what they're doing. Alright? Therefore, a child who's under the age, does not have the sufficient das, knowledge, mental capabilities to accept being Jewish. So therefore, the Gemara tells us when they reach the age of majority, 12 for a girl or 13 for a boy, they then have the option to opt out. So among the questions is, can this child opt out? This child who was born from the mother who converted during pregnancy, right, can she back out at the age of 12? Right, so there are many issues that come up to this. Inheritance, right? Are they necessarily related? Yes.
Going far afield, I find myself uncomfortable with this idea that a person being a convert after they're born, because that would mean that they're a person before they're born, and Jewish law doesn't,
So I think I mentioned the fact that we were talking about abortion, right? Did I mention that?
No, we're not talking about
abortion. Are we gone? So
we
going?
Are. I came a little late, maybe
you're wrong. No. So again, why do they give if a person is a person before they're born, if not for abortion?
Say that one more time.
Why do I care if a person is a person before a person is born,
right,
if not for the reasons of abortion? You're bothered by the concept that a person is a person before a person is born.
Well, I never thought a person was a person before they're born, but it sounds like from this discussion about are they Jewish or not Jewish, we now have the question again.
So again, one could make the argument that my comment of, is the fetus a limb of the mother, or is the fetus its own entity, is the question of, what is the status of an unborn child?
Right.
And that would probably have strong ramifications for the discussion of abortion.
Right.
And that would be a lecture unto itself.
Right, but it's...
So we're not going there.
But the door is open if we're saying that it's its own entity and it has to go through conversion.
And the door is closed if we say that's just the limb of the mother. Right? That, it seems to me that this
so
is the question.
Why is there a discussion about converting someone who was born of a Jewish mother? Why are we even having the discussion?
Why are we having it?
No. If the mother converted before the baby is born, she's now a Jewish woman.
Correct.
If she has a baby, that's a baby born of a Jewish
woman. Before she converted, she was a non-Jewish woman.
Correct.
She conceived the baby. Correct. That baby is?
Right. So if she's not Jewish, so, the baby's not Jewish.
Right, and at the time of conception, she wasn't Jewish.
But now she's converted.
Okay, so that's not a problem. We have to, let's say she gave birth and then she converted.
So you're saying that the issue after she's converted, there's a question or the child is not a Jew?
So I said, no, we said clearly the child is a Jew. The question is, why is the child a Jew?
Right.
Is the child a Jew because the child was born a Jew? Or
right.
The child a Jew because the child has undergone a process? So I said there were two opinions.
Got it.
Okay? All right? So, as we see from here that there are, in fact, the issue of the circumcision can have much confusion in it. Another case which is discussed is the case of a hemophiliac. What if a hemophiliac wants to convert? So again, three opinions. You thought there could only be two. One opinion is, sorry, no can do. Hemophilus cannot convert. Possibility number one. Possibility number two is, if you can't do it, you can't do it. You know, we move on, it's not necessary. Right? There are a lot of people who can have a bris and they still become Jewish. They're called women. So based on that, perhaps so too here, we can do it. And the third possibility is if you want to be part of the tribe, you really have to sow some Mesiris Nefesh. So, have a bris and see what happens. So, these are all issues with the Mila. All in all, most of it isn't that exciting. So that's step number one is the Mila. Next is the Tefillah. The person has to go into a kosher, a mikvah, and they have to, and at that point, they have to accept upon themselves to be Jewish. This has to be done in front of a Beis Din. It's interesting, so how do we know a Beis Din? We discussed today in the Chabura the issue of, we said everything we learn now comes from Har Sinai. Whatever happened at Har Sinai. So the question is, at Har Sinai, where was the Beis Din? Right? There was no Beis Din. In fact, there was no one Jewish there. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't Jewish beforehand. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu was a convert. So where do you know it from? So Rabbi Schefter has an interesting piece where he says that the purpose of the Beis Din being there isn't necessarily in order to decide anything. So usually a Beis Din decides things, right? You say, you owe me I owe you money. I say, you don't. The Beis Din decides who's right or wrong. There are other times when the Beis Din decides nothing, but rather they just have to be there. So this is one of the examples. We say in the Shir Shal Yom, on Tuesday, I think, Elokim Nitzav Adaskel, that whenever a Beis Din gets together, God comes down. So Rabbi Shapta uses to explain an interesting, unrelated question. So Shalom Aleichem has a story. Just want to go over there for a second. Shalom Aleichem tells a story about they went to a Moser, they went to the Tsar. Most Shalom Aleichem stories. And the Moser says, you know, the Jews, they swear to you that they are... committed to you and they swear allegiance, but they don't mean it. You know how I know? Because on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur, they all get together in the synagogue and they say, all the pledges of allegiance that we made are null and void. They say Kol Nidre. So therefore, they might pledge allegiance to you, but really they back out of it as soon as they can in the most public way. So I was very interested, so let's look into this. So he dresses up as a non-Tzar, and he goes out into the Jewish marketplace, and he goes by, sees a Jew on the street, and says, excuse me, sir. He says, yes, are you Jewish? Yes, I'm Jewish. Do you go to shul on Yom Kippur? Of course I go to shul on Yom Kippur. You say Kol Nidre? Who doesn't say Kol Nidre? Well, what does Kol Nidre mean? So Kol Nidre means, God, you are great, and we are small, and we have sinned, and we don't deserve to live, so please let us live another year. So I said, oh, that's Kol Nidre. Oh, great, no problem. The idea about the story being that no one understands what you're saying in Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre, you assume, if it's so important that it got put right before the Kol Nidre appeal, it must be something like that. But what Kol Nidre actually is just a bunch of people saying that, you know, doing Hataras Nedarim, or whatever, some vows, people, let's try to get out of it now. So, the question is obvious. Why was Kol Nidre placed right before the Kol Nidre appeal? Right? Why did it get such a good slot? So many answers are offered. Among them, Rabbi Schechter has this concept, as we said earlier, the Lakim Nitzav Adas Kel. Now, whenever a Beis Din gets together, the Shekhinah comes down. So, at the end of Yom Kippur, we say Hashem Hu Elokim seven times, and as the Shekhinah goes back up to the heavens, the question, well, how did it get here in the first place? So the answer is, Kol Nidre, and that brings the Shekhinah down, and therefore we have Yom Kippur, and then it goes up afterwards. So too here, in the case of the Ger, so Gerus is a covenant, it's a bris, and it's a bris between who? There are two parties in any covenant. This is between the potential convert and God. In order for any covenant to be made, both parties have to be there. So the Ger is here. What about the other party? So you bring in a Beis Din to bring down God. That's what they're there for. Now that's become difficult in around half the cases. Those cases I refer to are the ones that didn't have a bris. Beis Din was involved men. I haven't been attending the tzniyah shiur, but I imagine three men standing watching a woman go to the mikvah would be problematic. Right? Yes? Right. According to most opinions. That would not be considered bending over blackboards. I think we'd all agree on that. So, how do we deal with that? So, the general assumption of what happens is that the woman goes in the bathrobe, actually. The woman goes in the bathrobe, whatever has to happen, happens. Right? Then she goes under, the rabbis walk out, they slam the door. And that is how it traditionally happens in the major bat they did in New York. So that's the issue with the tefillah. Also not that exciting. Now we get to the controversy, which we've all been waiting for. So I actually read Jew vs. Jew today, so I know everything there is to know. So the major issue that always comes up, which is the major issue, which just gets recycled over and over again, is the issue of Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. In order to be Jewish, do you have to accept upon yourself the yoke of the mitzvahs? You have to say to yourself that I hereby agree, I will keep Shabbos, you know, I will keep Taras Mishpacha, I will keep family purity, you know, all of the mitzvahs to the extent that I can, I accept by myself to do the mitzvahs. Now, that doesn't mean that I understand all the mitzvahs, right? As we know, at Har Sinai, famously, the people said Ma'aseh v'nishma. You know, we accept everything, now we'll learn it afterwards, right? Meaning that we will accept to the extent that we can accept, right? And also, obviously, we're all human, we fail, but we are always trying to do correctly. So the question is, if somebody is not accepting upon themselves this, if they're they're doing conversion for whatever reason, it's interesting, a lot of interesting reasons why people convert. I remember years ago, I think this might still be true, Israeli Basketball League had a rule. They can only have two foreigners on the team at any given time. The question came up sometimes, what if we already have our two foreigners, and then somebody who's an excellent player gets caught with drugs or something, gets thrown out of the NBA, and now we can pick him up. So we've got a problem. We already have our two chutznikim. How are we going to get around this? So the answer became the law of return. We just make this guy Jewish, we make him Jewish, right? He then makes Aliyah, goes out of Nefesh Nefesh, like, waves to everybody, right? And he's now Israeli, and he's on the team, no problem. And there's a certain rabbi in the Midwest who was well known among African Americans 6'8" and over, and who were interested in converting him in somewhat of a short time period. So the question is, if somebody does this, are they Jewish? So let's say they have the bris, right? They go to the mikvah. They answer all the questions correct. Whatever you say, Rabbi, I'm right on. Is that person Jewish? So you'll note that I've never mentioned that there has to be an acceptance of the mitzvos at any point. I spoke about a karbon, I spoke about a bris, I spoke about going to the mikvah. I never spoke about whether or not they have to accept mitzvos or not. However, if you would go back a step and talk about Har Sinai, obviously accepting the mitzvos plays a pretty important role in that one. Right? Acceptance of the Torah is the whole idea. So the question is, how does that fit in? I mean, every disagreement that we're going to have, you know, politically, etc., over the last 20, 30, 40 years, etc., always comes down to that. Right? The argument this year between Rabbi Sherman and Rabbi Druckman came down to that. Right? There were certain people who got out there and said, if you have a person who comes from Russia, and he fights in the army, and he fights for the land of Israel, how can we not make him Jewish? And other people say, he's a good citizen, he obviously should be an Israeli citizen, but fighting in the army doesn't make you Jewish. You know, you can be non-Jewish and live in Israel. That's fine, we're happy to have the guy. But if you don't want to be part of the religion, sorry. Right? If the issue between the denominations, right? If one denomination says that we reject the idea that one can't do malacha on Shabbos, right? We reject the idea that there are 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, right? Many large swaths of the Torah we don't accept. And a person says, that's all what I accept, meaning I don't accept many of the mitzvahs. So the question is that enough? That is the basic question which comes over and over and over. So in order to answer this, I'd like to tell a story that you all know, the story of Rus. So the classic Yaris was Rus. Right? Her name indicated it. Rus has the numerical value of 606, right? Why was she called Rus? Because the non-Jews have 7 mitzvahs, the Jews have 613. She accepted upon herself the other 606 mitzvahs. That was Rus. Right? Many women who convert take on the name of Rus, right, as the prototypical case. The book of Rus is a short story. The Rashi in the beginning of Rus tells us that the book of Rus doesn't really have any halachas in it. Rather, it just goes to show that the great act of chesed she did and the reward that she got. Because she took care of her mother-in-law, because of that she had David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, and the entire Malchus, based on it, the Mashiach, all come out of Rus because of this. The obvious question people ask is that there are many mitzvahs in the book of Rus. Yeah, if you look there, for a small book, it gets a lot in. But there are 2 major themes of mitzvahs that we have there. One is conversion. Right? The dialogue between Rus and Naomi is the source for many of the halachas that we know. Right? We, the Jewish people, are not a proselytizing nation. We don't run around encouraging people to convert. If people want to, right, we actually discourage them. We point out to them that if you could be non-Jewish and you can go have the afterworld, you know, you might want to think about this. You might be better off the way you are. And in fact, we learned that all out from the discussion of Ruth and Naomi. It's interesting, though, when I was in law school, so I had an interview for a law firm, and it was a particularly not-Jewish firm. And the interview was particularly not Jewish. It was like John LePune III or something. And you know, it was obvious that to me, from the get-go, this was going nowhere. And I saw he had read my resume, which is an eye-opener. No one ever reads resumes on interviews, it seems. And he highlighted everything Jewish on it. Oh, and he's an anti-Semite. This is going to be fun. So we sit down, and he starts asking me questions. Then he starts asking me questions that sound like this. What do you know about Hillel? I said, the organization, camp, right? He said, the person. I thought, oh, there's the house of Hillel, there's the house of Shammai. He says, what are those 3 things he used to say? If I am for me, who am I? And so I said, well, give me a second, I'll do it in Hebrew, and I'll translate it for you. So then we go, okay, we're good discussing it, and time is up. And he said, listen, I'm sorry, time is up. And usually time is up, but, you know, since you really didn't get to ask any questions, you get one answer, one question. I said, fine, what's with you and Hillel? The guy turned red in the face, and he started shifting in his seat. And he said, I guess that's a fair question. I've been doing a lot of reading and I'm thinking about converting. Which I said, well. So which I said, I guess I'm supposed to say, what are you needed for? Hey! Come on! That's good! You have Red Lobster. Why do you want to convert? Come on. So Rus, the book of Rus and the dialogue between Rus and Naomi, that is the source for all of this. That is one theme. The second theme is the Rus and Boaz theme of the Levirate marriage, Yibum and Chalitza. Now we know if somebody loses their husband and they did not have children, right, the brother of the deceased is supposed to either marry the wife or perform a ceremony called Chalitza. And we know that before Boaz can marry Rus, there first has to be this discussion with Ploni Almoni to see if we can get past it. If you think about it, these two ideas cannot live together. It is impossible to say that Rus is a convert, and at the same time to say that there was a need for her to do Yibum or Chalitza. Why? Because if Rus was Jewish at the time that she married her husband, she couldn't convert afterwards. We let almost everybody convert, but Jews can't convert. We're pretty strong on that. So, if she was Jewish when she got married, she can't be converting now. If she was not Jewish at the time she was married, well, she can convert, but she couldn't be married. Halachically, we do not recognize a union between a Jew and a non-Jew. And since she was technically not married, her husband never died, because she didn't have a husband, and all the discussion doesn't make sense. So if you think about it, the two most basic points of the book of Rus don't get along with each other. How could it be on the one hand, she's converting, which indicates she wasn't Jewish, but she could be married, which indicates she was Jewish? One of the standard answers which is given is as follows. That oftentimes you'll have a situation where somebody converts and one cannot be sure if the intentions were pure or not. Did this person in fact convert for the sake of keeping the mitzvahs, or did the person just answer some pro forma answers because they wanted to have the title of Jewish but never intended to do anything with it? And oftentimes you cannot tell at the time. For example, in the case of both Rus and Orpah, they were marrying well. Mahlon and Kilion were wealthy, they were princes, things were good. And therefore, one could not tell, did they convert properly, or did they convert just in order to get married? After things turn sour, Mahlon and Kilion are dead, there is no more money, Rus turns to her daughter-in-law and says, you have an out now. If you never really wanted in, I understand you can get out. Now, if they were true converts, she would not have the option of doing that. Right? Once someone converts and someone is Jewish, they're in, like it or not. But rather, this was the test. This was the test to see whether they converted or not. And Rus, who says, no, I don't care. I became Jewish because I wanted to be Jewish. And it had nothing to do with the marriage, she remains Jewish, as opposed to Orpah, who says, good point, adios, implications that she was never Jewish. Now that's important, because Orpah is going to have a child, and that child's name is going to be? Goliath. Was Goliath Jewish? The assumption is not. And if he wasn't Jewish, his mother probably wasn't Jewish either. Right? So even though both Rus and Orpah both undergo conversions, and one would imagine they used the same Beis Din, the same everything, right? Right? Two brides for two brothers. Still, one comes out Jewish. Rus, the Messianic dynasty comes from her. You know, as Goliath, whose children aren't Jewish. How did that happen? So the answer is that it all depends on, is there an acceptance? Everything that we talk about, the bris, the tefillah, etc., That's all the ceremony. But the basis of converting is joining the Jewish nation and accepting to be part of the Jewish nation. It doesn't mean that you're going to like bagels and lox. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to tip less, whatever it is that Jews may or may not do. It's a matter of accepting yourself to be part of the Jewish nation. And therefore, Rus, who at the time it looked at the same, we see converted with a full acceptance of the Torah and mitzvahs, she remained Jewish, as opposed to Arpa who didn't. Interesting to note that David and Goliath were related. People don't always pick up on that today. Right? They were a few generations off, but David and Goliath, besides everything else, were mishpacha. Yes?
I'm feeling embarrassed to say this. I never understood that Ruth and Orpah were converted to be Jews, that part of the going down of this family was that they married non-Jewish women. My understanding, I can't remember where I learned it, was it had to do with her commitment to Naomi and coming back to the land of Israel. That it was never, that they were not Jews. So was my learning totally off here?
Well, again, if you'd assume that they were not Jews until later, right?
Neither were Jews.
Right, so if you assume that they were not Jews at the time they got married, right, that's your assumption?
You're talking about the first marriage to Naomi's children.
Right.
Naomi's boys.
Right.
Right.
So if you assume that was an intermarriage,
correct.
Right, then halachically, they were never married.
Okay.
And if they were halachically never married, Boaz would not have to wait to have somebody pass on the right because they were next.
Okay.
So that's the fault in that.
Okay.
Yes.
So with the idea of with the convert taking on the mitzvahs being part of the conversion, would that translate to this whole idea about is the fetus Jewish or not, in the sense of the intentions of who's the parents? And you know what I'm saying? It's like, is it the genetic or is it the caring mother? Well, maybe it's who's intending to have the baby.
So you're saying third possibility, whoever's raising the child.
Yeah, whoever's going through the hoops to make the arrangements to...
Interesting. There was a legal case in California, and you'll see this can only happen in California, where there was a case of child's custody where there were six potential parents.
Oh my gosh.
California is special like this. What happened was a couple decided they wanted to have children. So he recruited a sperm donor, and she recruited an egg donor. They made a child, and they put it into a surrogate mother.
Wow.
Right. Over the next 9 months, the couple broke up. Neither of them wanted a child. So the potential question is, were it the two people who arranged it? Was it the sperm donor the father? Was the egg donor the mother? Was the surrogate mother the mother? Or the person she was married to the father? Only in California did these things happen. Now, in terms of the physical status of the child, right? So you can't say whoever's going to raise it. Because let's say you have a non-Jewish child adopted by Jewish loving parents. Will that child have to undergo a conversion?
Yes.
Clearly. According to your understanding, they wouldn't.
But it's much later, though, your situation.
As a baby.
As a baby.
As a baby, right? Many children are adopted as babies. So on the one hand, I could dismiss the question like that. On the other hand, what you're saying is very good. Because, going back to the case of the child convert, We had raised the point, how could a child convert? The child can't accept the mitzvahs. The child doesn't have the ability to make a decision for themselves. But rather, we say that it's what's called zachnu adam shlo b'fanav. It's somehow, it is an advantage, it is advantageous for this child to be Jewish. And later on, we see whether that's true or not. The question is, it's advantageous if the child's going to get a proper Jewish education. What if the child is not going to get a proper Jewish education? Then it's no longer advantageous. There are cases that come up, which I've seen a few of them in my day, and I haven't been around that long. We have a non-religious couple that adopts, and they convert the child. Right? A conversion on a child isn't very tricky. Particularly if it's a girl, you take a job and the record's over. Thank you very much. Right? If you take a case like that, right, then the child grows up and they go on birthright and they want to become religious. So they're a convert. The issue is, well, is that true? Being that this child never got a Jewish education, at the time of the conversion, it wasn't necessarily a good thing to be Jewish. It's good to be Jewish if you know if you're going to go and you're going to keep the Torah and you're going to get the Olam Haba. If you're going to go and not keep the Torah, it's better not to keep seven mitzvahs than not to keep 613 of them. Right? And if you're going to be an ethical person, you're not going to steal. You might easily keep all seven, but not keep many of the other 606. So in a case like that, oftentimes what you're going to do is you're going to have to do another conversion, because the conversion at the time of the child was suspect because the people raising the child were not giving the Jewish education. So while having loving parents who are going to raise you in a Jewish way does not get you out of doing a conversion, it allows the conversion to work. Yes?
If a girl is converted into a child and then opts out later on, what children has the period when she was Jewish? She went back to become un-Jewish?
So
she has children before the family children.
So again, she's not going to have children before she's 12.
Why not?
Of course she's not, okay? So again, I think the definition of majority is physical maturity. Prior to reaching the physical maturity, she can't have children. Not in the last few thousand years. Okay, so I think we can all agree on the fact that the girl having a child before the age of 12 is unlikely.
It's none to none.
It's none to less. Right? We'll put it down as. However, I'll help you out here. What if, so, wine. So, most people have wine that says on it, mevushel. Right? Mevushel means that it's been boiled. Why do people boil their wine first? It doesn't make it taste better. Right? People say it makes it taste worse. The reason you do, because there's a rule that if a non-Jew pours your wine, right, it makes it not kosher. Okay? But if it was boiled before it, then. So let's say I had non-boiled wine, and my six-year-old child, who I adopted and converted, pours the wine. And then at the age of 12 or 13, depending on the gender, they opt out. Did I drink non-kosher wine? The answer happens to be yes. Now, ask me the next question. If you have a child who is adopted, who's under the age of 12, do you have to keep them off the wine? The answer is no. Because the assumption is that that doesn't happen. Not that I'm familiar with cases where it has happened. But if a child grows up in a Jewish home with a Jewish education, the assumption is they'll want to be Jewish. That's the assumption. It's interesting. I recently had a case, a very interesting case, where a guy came forward and he was adopted as a child. And he never knew he was adopted, actually. And the way he found out he was adopted is he went to Israel, he became a Baal Tshuva. They asked him, you converted, who did the conversion, etc. And they get, and no, he didn't know he was, they said to him, what's your Hebrew name? And he said, whatever. And they said, how do you know? He said, well, I have a Bris Milah certificate. The Bris Milah said, had his name been Avram Avinu. It dawned upon him that his father's name probably wasn't Avram Avinu. And he looked into it, he found out that he was adopted. That's how he found out he was adopted, at the age of 20.
Oh,
right? So, now it's a whole new ball game for religious reasons and otherwise. So, it's never dull out there. Yes?
At least among certain dayanim in Denver, people of the woman, the convert, it's done differently. The men are not out of the room, and there's no rule, and there's no violation of scene. The way that works is the potential convert is in the mikveh, with the body against the wall, back to the wall. The men walk into the room at a distance and either see your head or see nothing. And then the woman walks forward a certain step or two or whatever until her head is shown, and nothing else. And the Dayanim say stop, and they go through all the questions and the whole thing. And then she immerses. And the men wouldn't know she went down and witnessed it because the way her head went underwater, and there was no other part of the body sticking out of the water. And then the men leave the room. The woman gets out of the mikveh. So there's no leaving the room, no assumption.
So I assume the trade-off is what you gain by doing that is anyone who would argue that the robe is a potential chatzitza, what you lose on that is I assume that the woman would be more comfortable in the robe than not.
The ones I've been involved in, at least, it hasn't been discussed.
Okay. But again, I can't speak for women converts, but I could imagine if I was in that situation, I may feel more comfortable. That's the trade-off. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with that. Halachically, the tefillah is clearly good. And the question is, that's the trade-off. If you're more concerned about chatzitza, on the other hand, there is potential for more discomfort on the woman's behalf. Now, whatever has to be done by Mara. The case is tricky, as I said, because in certain cases, it's obvious. You know if somebody is or is not. But there are many cases where you can't be sure. For example, the Gemara discusses the case, which is the case from time immemorial, somebody converting to get married. And the Gemara actually says, the Gemara has the Mishnah actually starts by saying that in the event that a man is living with a non-Jewish woman, right, and she converts, they should not get married, it's inappropriate. The Gemara says, well, wait a second, maybe it's inappropriate. But your implication is that the conversion works. Even though she's converting for the sake of marrying this guy, still, the conversion works. They shouldn't get married because people will talk. But doesn't it work? And the Gemara discusses it at the end and says, yeah, actually the conversion works. You convert for the sake of getting married, it works. So how does that fit into everything I've said? So the Rishonim make it clear that the story is as follows, that we're not so into lishma. The person's intentions is better that they should be pristine. It says a Beis Din should not convert someone whose intentions are not pristine. However, if a Beis Din does convert somebody, and they say, I want to get married, and therefore I'm going to keep the 613 mitzvahs, and they do, they are Jewish. Even though it wasn't the love of God that drove them to do this, as long as they keep the mitzvahs, they're okay. And you know what? If these people say, I'm going to keep the 613 mitzvahs, because this is what I want, because I want to marry this person, and they jump into the mikveh, and 2 weeks later the engagement breaks off. And they say, well, that's the end of that. Guess what? It's not the end of that. They're still Jewish. Because you did a good conversion, you're in. And at the time, you really accepted it. The issue is that's very hard to read minds. Right? If there really is an acceptance, so again, if you have a situation where the person says, I do, I do, I do, and then they walk out and they go right out to McDonald's to celebrate, you have a pretty strong understanding that there was never an acceptance here. But what if you know? Up until the marriage, they go to shul like they were supposed to. Where do you draw the line? And that's where it gets really tricky. Because on the one hand, obviously, this probably wasn't the best move to allow it. On the other hand, not. So that's where the discussion really comes in halachically, with some opinions saying, listen, Rav Moshe Feinstein of Soloveitchik all said, listen, it's up to the dayan. The dayan's got to look and make a decision. What does it look like to you? Does it look like they're for real or does it look like they're not for real? If it looks like they're for real, they're Jewish and there's no getting out. If it looks like they're not for real, they're not Jewish. You got to make the call, and that's that. Other people say, no, no matter what, you can never decide. It could be they're Jewish. How can you decide they're not Jewish? Right? There may be Jewish. You know, it's this strange state of in-betweenness. And that's what leads to the many disagreements between the rabbis. It's interesting. The second kollel I ever did was in a small town, far smaller than Denver. And I was there for a while, and I was supposed to give a lecture to the community the last night there in the JCC. And the community was everybody. And it was supposed to be on magic of the supernatural, it's supposed to be on some esoteric, and I showed up there and I got to the stage and I said, listen, you know, I know I was supposed to speak about something else, but I've been here for a while now, and I decided I'm going to speak about intermarriage, because this is a real problem here. And you'll go to the synagogue and ain't bias, ain't shamais. There's no family that doesn't have something going on with it. And, you know, I feel it necessary to get up and speak against the intermarriage. And this was a very controversial topic in this community. You know, if we don't accept the non-Jewish spouse, we're going to lose the whole family. What about the children? I said, children aren't Jewish. You lost them already. It's over. This was going back and forth. And people stormed out. It was a very contentious speech. And then a person raised their hand and they said, tell me, Rabbi, if you had a situation where the rabbi, you know, knows that there's someone who's being converted just for the sake of the marriage, would you allow the wedding to happen in the shul? I said, I would not. They said, so why does the rabbi allow it? And he was sitting next to me. So as I think on my toes, I got a few options here. One is, let him have it and get out of town tomorrow. Which I did not do, for the record. The second one was, I said to him, listen, I said, the rabbi's a great man. I met the rabbi, he's a great scholar, he's a gentleman. Unfortunately, he's not a prophet. He's not a Navi. So if a person says they're going to keep the mitzvahs, he has no choice but to believe them. But I'm sure if he would agree with me that by the end of Shavuot Brachos, if it's clear they're not keeping anything, he'd agree with me that they're not Jewish, right? And he said, yeah. You know, so that's the issue here. This is very difficult. You know, it's rabbis are put into a very difficult situation when you have a major donor or the president of the synagogue or someone whose family's been here for a long time. So listen, my daughter went off to college, and now there's this guy here, and they're going to get married, and you've got to clean it up, Rabbi. And the question is, what's the rabbi supposed to do about that? The answer, I think, is that local rabbis should stop doing conversions. Period. I think that's why I strongly support the idea of a national Beis Din. The rabbi should say, listen, I'll do what I can. I'll call up. I'll support the candidate. But as you know, I don't do conversions. And in fact, this isn't such a crazy idea. There's hardly a community in the United States where the local rabbi will do a get. The assumption is that if someone needs to get a get, unfortunately, you bring in someone from the outside and they take care of it. It is unclear how it developed in such a way that while rabbis realize that gittin is something beyond their expertise, that everyone's doing conversions. And it's bad because it puts rabbis in very uncomfortable situations. It's hard to be objective when there's the proverbial gun to your head. And of course, this leads to problems when other organizations, for example, the Rabbanut of Israel, know that many rabbis do conversions they're not comfortable with because they have no choice. So that is why I think it's not a matter of capitulating to radical right influences. I think there's a lot of good sense in having shul rabbis get out of the conversion business. And that way they could support their candidates, they could sponsor the candidates, they can come forward and say, listen, you know, these are good people, they're good, doing good things, but not make the decision. Because that way they can also say, don't touch them, trust me, this is not a good situation. They'll be able to say that as well. And that, of course, will raise the bar. This, of course, will lead to conversions of people that are more committed, and also people who have converted will be more readily accepted because there's no one's going through the back of their mind, maybe they converted because. When you raise the standards and the conversions are done for people who truly deserve to be converts, and you should realize that we've commented many times in the Gemara that if someone does not accept a convert, that's a very bad thing if they deserve it. There was a story of Avram being punished because a convert came his way and he did not accept the convert. The convert goes on to marry Esav, and Amalek comes out of it because we would not accept a convert when we should have accepted a convert. Right? So the answer isn't to say no converts, as certain communities do. The answer is to embrace converts. People are converting for the right reason. Absolutely. It is a mitzvah to convert them. It says in the Gemara in Yevamos that when someone proves themselves to be a true convert, we do it as soon as possible. Why? Because whenever you can do a mitzvah, you do it as soon as possible. What's the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to accept converts. According to many opinions, if you convert a young child, so you have a baby, a 2-month-old baby who's converting, So part of the process is you make a bracha. After you convert, you make a bracha. It's perhaps, or if not the only, one of the very only cases where we make a bracha after we do the mitzvah. Right? Because you can't make a bracha beforehand. What if the baby's 2 months old? Who makes the bracha then? So according to many opinions, the Beis Din makes the bracha. The Rambam says the Beis Din makes the bracha. Why does the Beis Din make the bracha? The Beis Din makes the bracha because it's a mitzvah to accept gerim. If someone who's converting for a true reason, if I have to say gerim, we reach out and we embrace them. However, when the situation of conversion comes to the point that all converts are suspect, that's terrible. It's particularly terrible for the people who are true converts. So that's why I think that this controversy is a long-running controversy, and I think actually streamlining it would be good for everybody.
So, I'm familiar with the situation whereby a couple gets married. The wife converted before the marriage, mm-hmm. with all good intentions, mm-hmm. and the children are born. Children are very committed, and the wife ceases to be committed all the time. Happens to those children?
So the assumption is, obviously this is fact specific, the assumption is when she converted, she 100% converted. So she is now Jewish, period, 100%. I know of a case of a fellow who is in yeshiva, not our yeshiva, but an equivalent thereof, where the mother converted, she had the children in yeshiva, and now she went off to Hare Krishna. Actual case? Had the fellow over for Shabbos. No doubt about his Judaism. What happened? It's the same as if she was born Jewish, unfortunately, would have run off to Hare Krishna. No difference in that case. Yes?
The basic idea is that accepting or not accepting the discretion of the Beis Din, you go to a third party Beis Din, while you have the advantage of no conflict of interest, they're totally disconnected from the people. How can their discretion and judgment be superior to somebody knows the couple and sees
them
on a basis?
Well, what are you assuming they're making their decision based on?
Who's
the third party basis.
I don't know, whoever it is, there's got to be less information than the local government has.
So, yes, and that's not bad, because they will interview. They'll interview the rabbi, they'll interview, etc. They will interview the person, and they will make an honest decision. And on the one hand, they have no pressure to accept, and they have no pressure not to accept. You know, if they ask them questions and they see that they have studied and they've learned that much about Judaism and they know how to bench when you finish eating and they know, and you know what they've heard about the 39 malachas and they know the basics of Judaism, obviously they're interested. You know, if they come forward and they say, yes, I want to be Jewish, I remember my brother-in-law is a congregation rabbi in Muncie. Muncie's not a big place for converts. But one time he got a couple, a woman came up and said, I want to convert. And I want to do the real way. I want to be an Orthodox. You know, I want to be Orthodox. I want to be an Orthodox. Right, you know? Yeah, just like when you have a case, a monetary case, it's important that the three judges not have any preconceived notions. It's helpful in this case as well, I think.
So what's happening with Israel in here and what's going on?
Well, so here's what is happening, as opposed to what some people are saying. What happens is as follows. So Israel realizes there were several rabbis in the greater U.S., Canada area that were doing conversions that weren't necessarily vetted properly. Right? There used to be a rule that any member of the RCA, automatically, without any questions, their conversions are accepted. There was a realization that that wasn't the best idea. So therefore, the rabbinate met with the RCA and said, you know, we would like you to check off on your members, confirming that they know what they're doing. They have checked off on some of their members, saying that they knew what they're doing. Nobody's questioning any of the conversions that were done previously. It's a matter of going forward, setting up a situation where there's more accountability.
So there's not nullifications?
There are no, there have been, and as far as I know, there will be no nullifications of any other conversions. And anybody who was accepted, and this is going forward.
What's the situation whereby you have a baby that gets converted at but they don't get asked the question when they become of knowledge. And then they go on to carry on with a, call it, you know, in and out Jewish life. And then at some point when they want to get married, they haven't really accepted it officially, but they want to get married Jewish at that point.
Let me just ask you one question. This child knows they were converted?
It's a hypothetical case. I'm just interested.
Right, okay, but I need some more information for my hypothetical. That's
okay,
the point.
Okay, they do know they were converted.
So again, assuming the child knows
they had a brief, and they knew they had a brief.
That doesn't prove much.
Yeah, but the Mohel says now you're Jewish. That is...
A typical 8-year-old Brit, you know, there's not much of a conversation that goes on between the Moel and the Rachamimo. It's funny, I was once at a bris, and I was sitting next to a fellow, and there was a student in yeshiva, and the baby cries, and he said, oh, that must have hurt. So I said, yeah, I know the light. After you got your bris, you couldn't walk for a year afterwards. Which he said, no, it was like 2-3 days.
You were a convert.
Oh, it took me longer. You're a better man than me. But back on the question. So the idea of, there is no official accepting ceremony. The idea is, if the moment you are bar mitzvah, bas mitzvah, you say, I want out, you're out. If you don't say anything, you're in. There might be an exception if you didn't know. If you don't know, and then the moment you find out, you say, I'm out, that also might work. That's machlokes. But if you know that you're a convert and you say nothing, it's interesting. I was once invited by a couple who wanted me to be a member of the Beis Din at their son's bar mitzvah, so you can accept the mitzvahs. I told him, we don't do that. Assuming he's a nice fellow, he was going to yeshiva, he's very happy. That's it. We don't have to announce that he was adopted. We don't announce he was a convert. He wasn't adopted. The whole family in this case converted. You know, that's it. It just happens. There is no acceptance. Yeah.
Are there other proposals out there on kind of improving the situation for the Jewish community?
So full disclosure, I am a member of the GPS. For a long time, I didn't even know what the GPS was. So, what? But it's funny because, so I got a call. It was a long time that the RCA starting this Gators thing, they'd like me to be a member of it. I said, it doesn't make sense, I should, because A, I'm not a member of the RCA, and B, I don't do Gators. But besides that, I'm probably your man. So I have no idea what you asked. They explained to me why they wanted me to be on it. So I told them that, no. So if I say, okay, I'll be a member of it, but no meetings. I'm not going to attend your meetings, okay? But sometimes you vote, call me up, I'll vote, but I'm not going to the meetings. And they said, fine, deal. Then they call me up and they said, you've got to come to a meeting. I said, well, we have a deal. And they said, no, the Rabbi Meir is coming, he's the chief rabbi, and et cetera. So I was sitting at this table, and lots of rabbis around it, and they served salmon, which was nice. Noodles were soggy. That's what the meeting meant to me, actually, at that point. And they were going around the table, who is everybody? And some guy said, well, I'm in charge of the GPS. Or Barry Freundel, so he's in charge of the GPS. So I turned to Rabbi Alan Schwartz next to me and said, what's the GPS? And he said, it's the thing that tells your car where to go. And I said, and he invented it? That's cool. He said, no, it's probably not that then. So he said, he was like, great public speaker. I said, and he's in charge of that? That's also cool. Not that either. So it's gears, procedures, and standards we were let down to find out. So it was actually kind of humorous because we went to the table and anyone introduced himself. So I said, hi, my name is Danny Rapp. I'm a Rabbi in YU. So he said, you're not a Rabbi in YU. Why are you here? I said, that's a great question. I have no idea. So we moved on. The fish? It was funny because when the Rav Nut sent out their first list of accepted rabbis, so there were only 5 people on the list, and I was one of them, which is, I thought was clerical error, but it seemed that he thought it was some great anuf, some great humility that I wouldn't say why I was there. And I really had no reason. As I said, so I'm not feigning ignorance. This is the real deal. You know? So I am involved in this, and it's interesting because over the years there's been blackouts. So I remember the first 2 weeks I did 8 women. So from everything to Rabbi Willig and saying, you know, Rashi comments that just like a ger sheniskaya could call them shenova dummy, someone converts as if they were born, the business is as if they're the parents that gave birth to them. He said, eight more daughters? Cut me a break here, you know? A lot of weddings to do. I know that people are unhappy with it. I know there are people who are threatening to do other things. I don't know what they are, though.
Okay, so if, let's say, you had someone who wanted to convert, who had very noble intentions, they really, really wanted to be part of the Jews, etc., but so they plan on keeping major mitzvos, but they plan on being, let's say, lenient Orthodox, and they don't plan on being exceedingly observant. And you know this from the outset. The Beis Din then has this great onus of their shoulders of, like, you don't want them to now be chayev in all sorts of averos that they didn't have before.
So the question is, what do you mean that they're going to? They're doing this because they grow up in a neighborhood, in a community where people are generally lax in this, and therefore they think it's okay?
Maybe.
Or is it because I just don't like that one? If it is the former, so they're accepting everything as they understand it, and therefore they're Jewish. If they decide, I just don't like that one, Hanukkah rubs me the wrong way, you know? So I'm not doing it, right? So that's it, you're out. It has to be all of the Gemara tells us, even if there's one rabbinic edict that they don't like, it's out. So again, if they accept everything and their understanding of everything is not everything, that's okay. But if they understand everything and they don't want that one, no good. Yes?
Yeah, Rabbi, how many currently are on these super based bins, and what's the geological breakout throughout the United States?
So I have no idea is the first answer. But my understanding is that there are satellite bait bins throughout. I know Seattle has one. Rabbi Kotenik is in charge of it. I know Chicago has one. And I imagine a lot of other places do as well. Baltimore, you have one? Want one? No, I really haven't. What? Los Angeles, I imagine. I just don't know. Again,
large cities.
Right, I'm small cog. I'm not. I've only attended one meeting, as I made clear. Maybe I should know better, but I don't. Yes?
With your experience, what is the majority of the conversion? Men or women?
Women.
A great majority?
It's interesting. They say in Bali Tshuva, for example, in NTSY, it's 70% female. I think the conversion breakdown might be similar. My experience might not be worth that much.
Plus, in my mind, it's the women primarily who want to get married would convert.
It's interesting because in my mind, women tend to be more spiritual than men. And therefore, they have more of this drive. Again, I don't convert people that are doing it for the sake of marriage. So that doesn't really come into play. I think it's more in terms of the spiritual searching. I think women naturally have more of the inclination.
Rabbi, I've heard, I don't know how true it is, but where a Beis Din has turned down or postponed a conversion based upon the rabbi that the people are going to get trained to learn about the mitzvah stuff. They didn't agree with that particular rabbi doing that.
I am unfamiliar with such cases. I would imagine if potential convert came forward and said, I didn't go to any rabbi, but I read all these books, and now I know everything, and I'm good to go. I would think that would be fine as well. So I don't think that, you know, the sponsoring rabbi plays that important of a role.
If a ger comes into a community, moves in, you know, and the community knows that he's a ger, do they have some kind of chiyuv to find out about his gers? Was it kosher? Who did it?
So if there is a potential issue, I mean, you want to count them for a minion or give them an allegiance, you want to know it. But there's no reason to assume that a ger has an issue. I mean, just because they're a ger, so what? If a ger moves into the community and you know that the community they're coming from didn't have any Orthodox rabbis, you know, or something like that, that there's that there's something that would raise an eyebrow, then maybe you look at the Jesse Ger shows up at your door and says, "Hi, I'm Ger, I'm Jewish, I'm happy to be here. We're happy to have you." Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.